Welcome to the Biogeometric Integration Community Call Series, a monthly call for the chiropractic profession, hosted by Dr. Amy Burke. The topic for this call is How to Deeply and Best Serve People with a History of Trauma, presented by Dr. Tanya Tyre, recorded on March 9, 2010.
Tonight's call is going to be led by our amazing staff person, chiropractor, mother, genius, Tanya Tyre. And she's practicing in two places in North Vancouver, and I will let her give us the details on that. But Tanya's, in my experience, Tanya, your attention to detail and to subtlety is impeccable and inspirational. And so I so look forward to hearing what you have to say about working with people who have been through traumatic events when they're in our office and how we can serve them to a higher level. So thank you for suggesting the topic of the call, and we'll get started.
Okay, well, I just want to preface this by saying that I don't really consider myself an expert in the area of trauma. It's just something that's really come to my attention a lot in practice. It's something that I think that as people who work with the general communities, just having a really good understanding of trauma and its implications from a clinical standpoint would really help us honor these people, help us honor their evolution as they go through life and take on the challenges that they're faced with when they're dealing with how traumatic events have affected them. I just want to also say that I'm going to cover actually quite a bit of theory, but also some clinical pearls. And, you know, this information isn't meant to make us step into the role as a psychotherapist with these people, but really sometimes understanding these things from a theoretical standpoint helps us understand, first of all, how this works, and then how it affects the person. And then just from there, we can really tailor things to each individual, because what happens to these people is that their world and their perception is so changed by traumatic events, and there are so many different things to consider in their process that, you know, just understanding that stuff can really, really help us serve them. One thing I will say, too, is that, you know, the thing about dealing with people who've had traumatic events in their life is that, you know, if we're not careful and sort of respect certain things, that we could actually have a negative impact on these people's lives and not actually give them the opportunity to have the benefits that we can give them. So it's really a matter of just trying to understand something like post-traumatic stress disorder and how it affects people and those kinds of things. So anyway, so the other thing I would love to say is that, you know, for me in practice, I found BGI as an approach can be so useful from a clinical standpoint when working with these people. There's so much that helps them with regards to being aware of their body. As we address the nervous system, it's so helpful to them because it's so deeply affected by it. And we'll get into this a little bit more as we go along, but one thing I will say, too, is that my experience of the BGI community is that there's such a depth of character and intuition within the community of practitioners that I really feel that, you know, we can really set the bar high for how well we serve these people. So I guess I'll hop into the theory now, and I will say this, too, is that if people really want a PowerPoint presentation, because I pretty much have this all kind of done up on PowerPoint just to keep my head organized, you're welcome to email me. My email is info@drtanyatyre.com. So if you need to look up the spelling of my name, it's just all one word, all small case, that kind of thing. It should be on the website. So anyway, so looking at this, you know, really when we're dealing with trauma, there can be, you know, a multitude of results. Some people can experience a traumatic event, process it, resolve it, and be completely free of any long-term effects. And, you know, this is an ideal situation because, you know, we can't necessarily prevent traumatic events from occurring, but, you know, that's ideal. But then there's also a few other results, too, that can occur. And this is really what I'm trying to delve into is, in one instance, a person could remember the event in detail, and for some reason they can't make sense of it or some sort of aspect of it, and then they become so disturbed by intense emotions and intense bodily sensations, and this kind of just plagues their daily life and can affect how they function in the world. Another result is that a person could feel really numb in their body or their emotions and complain of a sense of deadness in their lives. It's almost like they've disengaged from life and disengaged from their body. So, and then the other result is that sometimes people have absolutely no recollection, if any, of a traumatic event. Then they're plagued by these sensations in their body and emotional reactions to things that make no sense within the context of the situation. And this is a really important thing to understand when we're working with these people, because sometimes I think we don't necessarily, sometimes when we have people whose behavior seem a bit strange, we don't necessarily, they don't always report to us that they've had traumatic events. And so it's sometimes really kind of important to kind of keep that in the back of your head when you're working with these people so that you know to really see conflict through to the end so that you kind of really get a sense of what you're dealing with. And you might find out a lot more information about people if you are up for doing that. And so really, when we look at PTSD, so that's post-traumatic stress disorder, and that's what can occur after trauma, you know, those last few categories I talked about, really what's happening is that the mind becomes so overwhelmed, it's not able to process a traumatic event to completion anymore and file it away and relegate it to the past. And that's really what we want to understand is why is that happening and how can we help them actually do that. So, and as with anything in whenever we're looking into the field of psychology, there's a lot of theory and there's a lot of concepts that come out of clinical practice, and there's sometimes a great chasm between the two. And, you know, it can be really hard to kind of put all that information together and actually make it work from a clinical standpoint. And especially with PTSD, it gets a little more complicated because the symptoms are psychological and somatic. So they have psychological symptoms and a lot of body symptoms. And unfortunately, too, this means that people who work with these people really have to kind of sometimes step out of their comfort zone with respect to what their discipline is in order to really address that whole person and that how that affects their entire physiology. So, and yeah, anyway, and the biggest thing is that by understanding this, you can then gain the ability to adapt to the needs of each individual as you're working with them. So anyway, I'm going to get into, I guess, why PTSD starts. So PTSD, again, is post-traumatic stress disorder, and it occurs in response to three types of events. So usually the events that trigger PTSD are things that threaten one's life or the integrity of their body. Sometimes being a witness to acts of violence to others can trigger it. We see this a lot even with probably, you know, people more familiar with these stories maybe with war vets and things like that. And then hearing of violence or to the unexpected or violent death of close associates. So there's a few different reasons that PTSD occurs. I'm sure we could probably add to that list in detail and to all the different things, you know, that can occur to somebody. But some of the symptoms that it presents with are things like the re-experiencing of the event, an avoidance of anything that reminds them of the event. And this is probably the most important thing and where we can be the most helpful is the chronic hyperarousal of the autonomic nervous system. So you see symptoms such as rapid heart rate, heart palpitations, cold sweats, rapid breathing, hypervigilance, and a hyperstartle response. And almost what's happening, though, is that even though the threat is no longer there, there's a continued perception of the threat in their mind. And usually what happens when we're dealing with a threat is the cortisol levels go up, but they don't really go up high enough to halt the alarm. And so it's something that just flags them in their daily life. For some reason, this hyperarousal keeps going on. And so, you generally diagnose PTSD, once these symptoms last more than a month and they see a lack of function in areas such as one's life, like work or social relationships. So the thing that I'd really like people to be aware of, too, is that, when when PTSD becomes really chronic, the symptoms that also present along with it, really make it a vicious cycle. From what I've seen in my practice, I've seen a lot of hormonal disturbances to digestion and absorption of nutrients, pathologies in the organs associated with, say, abuse or something like that. Pathology and problems in just a whole bunch of different areas. I've even seen degenerative diseases such as MS come up probably with a correlation to the PTSD. See a lot of fatigue and energy issues, adrenal burnout, symptoms that are all over the place. So sometimes when you see cases that are really kind of a mess and you start seeing this hyperarousal of the autonomic nervous system, you probably know that's there. One thing I have learned is that, sometimes people come in and they don't disclose what's really going on with them because it just takes them so long to build trust with people. And once they trust you, they'll let you know. So sometimes it's good to just keep a lid on your curiosity, but keep the door open for the dialogue. So, and then the next thing we're going to talk about is just, let me just skip that part there. So one of the things that we're going to talk about is basically with PTSD is that essentially those people go through the world not being able to analyze what's going on in the actual current situation because they keep re-experiencing these physical sensations from the hyperarousal of the autonomic nervous system, et cetera. And so that's, that production of intense emotions and not being able to modulate them and can really make them kind of difficult to work with from a standpoint of just, just day-to-day things. I found sometimes my office staff is a little bit harassed by these people, but, all those things kind of do help us point out what's going on and then what also needs to be worked on, and we'll talk about that a little bit down the road. So anyway, and good. So what we're going to talk about here is, sorry, I'm just following my notes and I've got lots of them, is just how trauma impacts the body. So one of the first things we're going to talk about is the nervous system responses. Now, we've all heard of fight, flight, or freeze, probably. And during the trauma, usually people have one of those experiences. They'll have a fight. If they can, they'll fight. If they can, they'll flight. If they can't do either of those, then they'll freeze. But what's happening too then is then it becomes a phenomenon that affects their daily functioning. They'll get that sensation and they'll want to do something like fight or flight or freeze. And it really, what they choose really is just a matter of perception of the situation. So one of the other things that occurs, and this is actually probably a really important thing to understand, is dissociation. And it's likely a constant factor in most, like in pretty much all cases of PTSD. And basically dissociation is a splitting of awareness. Now, some of us kind of are a bit familiar with it because, it can range from forgetting why you were going into the kitchen and to even the extreme of dissociative identity disorder, which most people know as multiple personality. And basically what happens is that at the time of the trauma, there can be an altered sense of time, reduced sensations of pain, absence of terror or horror, and this may be similar to freezing. One of the things that they talk about is that really it could potentially be the mind's attempt to flee when it's not possible. And it's considered maybe a neurobiological phenomenon, and it happens under extreme stress. But, you know, from what I've seen, too, is that most of the people in my practice who are dealing with multiple personality disorder or have integrated those personalities at this point in time, they seem to be very intelligent people, and it's almost like they have a really agile brain, which I found really interesting. And a lot of times, too, what's interesting is that it's like many of these people seem to live in an experience that is from the neck up. And this is really important. It's like they don't really feel the rest of their body. And one thing that I do find is that if they get symptoms in elsewhere in their body, you know, make sure that they investigate it if no relief comes about, because it might actually be something quite problematic or quite far gone. It's almost like something really has to scream extremely loudly for them to take notice, because they just aren't checked into the rest of their body. It's like they can just completely dissociate from those pains or signals that come from the body, and so many of us are just so used to being, you know, quite in tune with what's going on in our bodies, but that's not really where they're at. So Beth starts to, you know, make sure that these people are listening and that it gets checked out. So there we go. And then the other thing that can happen is people can suffer from flashbacks, and most people know what those are. You know, primarily they're visual or auditory, but they can also be emotional, behavioral or somatic. They do talk about young children sometimes acting them out as a behavior. So, and then the next thing we're going to talk about is memory. And this is actually quite important, just because, you know, there's different ways that our brain stores memories. And the first type of memory we're going to talk about is implicit memory. So sorry about the vocabulary, guys, but basically an implicit memory is an unconscious and emotional memory, and it's mediated by the amygdala. This area of the brain's actually not suppressed by stress hormones or highly aroused states, so when we're experiencing a trauma, this area of the brain's still working. And so since it's still working and we're dealing with emotions and all that kind of stuff, you know, it's the part that we actually are able to remember more than anything. But then the next type of memory that we're going to talk about is an explicit memory, and it's conscious and narrative, mediated by a different part of the brain, the hippocampus. And so really what happens is that this leaves the person with these emotions and sensations and behavioral impulses, and they don't really have access to the context to it, because it's two completely different memory systems. And so that's kind of why they think that, you know, these people are left with intense bodily sensations, hyperarousal in the autonomic nervous system, but without having a context to it, because those two types of memories were stored completely differently. So, and then the next thing we're going to talk about, and this is really actually more, you know, what we need to start watching out for as chiropractors. And one is to, as we're working with these people, is to evaluate their resources. And the more resources a person has, really makes the prognosis more hopeful. And we can also encourage people to build on their resources and also be part of the resources that they have in their life. One of the first things you want to do is make sure their physical home is safe, that you know what kinds of things trigger them, so that then your office can be a safe place. You know, but I'll be honest, you know, people who are really quite dealing with trauma and are really, really quite intolerant of different situations, you probably won't find them in your office right away. The people who are really bad, you'll probably find that they've worked with somebody for a really, really long time before they're even able to make it into your office, even though they probably needed to be there years before. Hopefully, you know, that's one of the big things is making sure your office is a safe place for them, and hopefully that their home is a safe place for them. The other type of resources are things like functional resources. Do they have a reliable car and locks and that kind of thing? Working with them on how to drive, you know, encouraging them to look into things like defensive driving classes if they've been in an MBA and that's really where they're dealing with PTSD or things like that. Another set of resources would be physical resources, things like strength and agility. Some people really feel a confidence when they increase their strength and agility. And for some people, say, for example, who are terrified of earthquakes and have been traumatized by an earthquake, you know, sometimes, you know, just things like doing some drills, you know, as to what you would do in this moment in order to, if an earthquake occurred, like what would you do and practice it. And sometimes that really brings down that hyperarousal that can occur and lead to quite a bit more confidence. So every situation is different, every story is different, but these are just sometimes simple things that, you know, sometimes can really shift somebody's physiology in terms of the hyperarousal. Psychological resources, things like intelligence, sense of humor, curiosity, creativity, whether it be artistic or musical, almost all defense mechanisms, such as, you know, withdrawal, anger, dissociation. Now, the thing about defense mechanisms is that they can be self-defeating or helpful. And so sometimes just because we do play a role with these people in terms of having a relationship with them, our office staff has a relationship with them, that kind of thing, is also working with them when they're doing something that is self-defeating. And I think that, again, comes down to when conflict arises, really try to see it through if you can and keep that contact, because, you know, they do need more and more examples of positive relationships where conflict does get resolved, and also to become aware of when they don't, you know, that they don't need to be angry or that they don't need to withdraw, that they can actually, you know, make a different choice in terms of their response to things. Another set of resources is interpersonal resources, things like spouse, family, friends, animals. You can actually, you know, use memories of people in order to soothe some people when the hyperarousal levels get a little bit higher. And these are very significant resources to calm that autonomic nervous system down. And then also spiritual resources, believing in a higher power or following a religious figure. Now, the thing is that for some people, they've maybe felt betrayed by this or that kind of thing. But, you know, sometimes it's good to encourage them to reclaim that positive impact that it's had in their lives previously. So, and then one thing I do want to talk about, and it's an interesting topic, and that is the topic of attachment. Now, one of the things that they do say is that this can, you know, whether somebody had, you know, healthy attachment during infancy, you know, can really modulate somebody's response to a trauma. So, you know, healthy attachment is something that actually enables us to cope better as we go through life and deal with different issues and trauma and that kind of thing. And it's not that it's the only factor to predicting PTSD, but it's something interesting to look at. And the other thing is encouraging people to have, if they don't have that healthy attachment that they should have had during infancy, is making sure that they have mature relationships. And not that you can make sure of that, but encouraging it, because that can go a long way for making up for that. One of the things that I find interesting about attachment is I've done a bunch of reading on it, and I've really only found resources that explore extreme cases of poor attachment. And, you know, I think we, in today's society, we're seeing more and more problems with attachment, but on a subtle level, because we're not necessarily engaging with our children as much as we should. And, you know, I'm not sure that they're always getting everything they need from their moms and things like that. So I think that's a really important thing to consider, is that I think there's sort of, you know, areas of, okay, excellently healthy versus, okay, that wasn't good at all, and somewhere in between. So, and that somewhere in between, I haven't found much information on at this point in time. So, and, you know, even with healthy attachment, I think one thing we have to remember too is that when stress is extreme, it can still trigger chronic mental illness in people who've had healthy attachment and happy childhoods. And Holocaust survivors are a really, really good example of that. So, you know, it doesn't necessarily exclude you from that, but it can definitely play a role. Now, one thing I'm going to get into now is more theory. Sorry, guys, is classifications. Now, the only reason why I see these important is because it helps us kind of look at comparing, you know, how severe is this case and how do the resources that a person have affect it. You know, type 1 people are people who've experienced a single traumatic event. They have a type 2 for people who've been repeatedly traumatized. And then they then subcategorize the type 2s into A's and B's, 1 being people who have had multiple traumas but yet come from very stable backgrounds, and this has imbued them with lots of resources to separate each trauma out so that, you know, people can... psychotherapists can work with each trauma and one at a time. So, and then type B of the type 2 are so overwhelmed with so many traumas that they're unable to separate one event from another. And from there, they again give 2 subcategories to that. One where people have stable backgrounds but are so overwhelmed there's no longer any resilience. So a Holocaust survivor would be a really good example of that. And then one where they've never developed any resources for resilience. You know, they maybe haven't had that family support, all those different resources there for them. And to be quite honest, you will likely not see those people in your office until they've done a lot of work with somebody, and then you'll probably find them in your office. But, you know, just to keep your eye out for them, because they do make it in, you know, once they've probably done years of therapy, but probably won't see them until then. So the other thing is that they have a classification, and I think this is actually a really important classification because I've seen this actually quite a lot, is they call it prolonged duress stress disorder. And, you know, again, just a classification where there's been no event, no traumatic event, but the stress is just so prolonged and enduring that they present with PTSD symptoms. And so I think, you know, there's something to be said about that, because I do see a lot of people in my practice who not necessarily have dealt with a traumatic event but are dealing with symptoms similar to that. So the next topic we're going to talk about is risk. And this is, again, really, really important. You know, as you're working with people, because we put our hands on people, and this is really, you know, a boundary that not many people have the privilege of crossing. You know, you really run a risk of overwhelming somebody so that they end up decompensating, having anxiety attacks, flashbacks, or re-traumatization. In psychotherapy, they have a paper that they put out called Reliving versus Relieving. And actually, Relieving versus Reliving got that mixed up. And I think that's a really important point that, you know, you don't... You know, it's not uncommon for people to go through a loss of function in their daily lives as they go through the process of addressing these traumas. But I think one of the things that we really have to remember is that we're really probably, especially our role, we're really there to help, you know, relieve some of the ANS arousal, help them improve their coping skills and their daily functioning, and this is where we really can play a positive role. We don't necessarily have to get into the traumas or anything like that, but, you know, just knowing that that's what our role is, and that as we go through that process, just really keeping an eye out for, you know, not really pushing that person into an even more hyper-aroused state in the autonomic nervous system so that they don't actually cross that line of becoming really overwhelmed or anything like that. So, you know, some of the things that you want to watch for as you're adjusting them is just a change in breathing. Is their breathing getting more rapid? Are they becoming a little bit sweaty and cold? And are you seeing some pallor and that kind of stuff? So if you see some, you know, we're always watching for breath and things like that. So if we see we can keep an eye out for these things. And next, I'm going to talk about a few tools that you can use that should something like that arise, that you can kind of pull them out of your handbag there. And one of them is just bringing people back to something that gives them relief, a feeling of relief in body and mind. So that could be like a person, a pet, a place, an object, an activity, just something that really kind of relaxes their system or help them, encourage them to think of a safe place, a current or remembered site of protection. You know, it doesn't really have to be perfect, but good enough to just kind of get them, you know, to settle down again. One of the things that, you know, can be useful for when they're on their own, if they're having a hard time, you know, using these, is to just find an activity that demands their concentration. You know, something that's easy, but yet they need to pay attention. So that can actually really help them get their mind off of it. So, and the next thing we're going to start diving into is the concept of body awareness. And this is actually, again, where we can really help people. We, in terms of senses, we have senses that feel, sense our external environment, so they're exteroceptive. And then we also have senses that help us take note of our internal environment. So those are things like proprioception, vestibular senses, just knowing what's happening in our gut and that kind of stuff. You know, and those internal senses, the interoceptive senses, are actually really important because, you know, there are some people, I don't know if you guys have ever heard of Antonio Damasio. He has a theory called somatic markers. And basically his theory is that emotions are comprised of body sensations that are elicited in response to various stimuli. So, you know, the interesting thing here, though, is too, is that, you know, happy excitement and fear actually can feel quite similar. And so just, you know, this is something to kind of be mindful of. But, you know, this is a really important concept. And he also talks about how you actually need to be able to feel the consequences of a decision in order to be able to make a rational decision, which is, I thought, kind of an interesting concept in terms of understanding how we make decisions and how we are affected by them. So if you have something like PTSD going on and you're constantly in that state of hyperarousal, it's really hard for those people to, you know, come to rational conclusions and things like that. So, you know, and really what we want to do in the adjusting process is use the body as a resource and an ally and really start to work with, you know, helping people perceive their bodies, whether they're dealing with dissociation or just hyperarousal, those kinds of things. We can really, you know, understand when their body's starting to head into that state of hyperaroused autonomic nervous system function, and also help them get back into their bodies. You know, you can just start with just, you know, so what are you feeling in your body? Just asking simple questions, you know, can they feel the table and are they comfortable and do they want to change positions? And I think that's a really important thing when you're working with these people. And also, too, when we ask these types of questions and just make sure things are, you know, feeling good for them, that it increases their sense of safety. So, and I know in psychotherapy they often will, you know, having an awareness of your body is actually, they find really important to just restoring function to these people. So the next thing we're going to talk about is the concept of dual awareness. Now, dual awareness comes into body awareness, but it's really, they call it the ability to maintain awareness of one or more areas of experience simultaneously. Now, what happens in PTSD is that they're paying way too much attention to internal stimuli and interpreting the world from that point of view. And then that means the concurrent reality is evaluated on just that restricted information. And just sometimes acknowledging this is helpful to the person. So when something, you know, is coming up and that kind of thing, that's a really important perspective to help them gain. So, and then another issue that comes up with body awareness is the concept of muscle toning. There are some people, and you probably all run into them, where it seems that holding tension is what relaxes them, and reducing tension precipitates stress and hyperarousal of the ANS and that kind of thing. And you know what? They often say, well, then those people shouldn't do things like massage and relaxation things because they're not benefiting from it. But I think actually they can benefit a lot from adjusting. More because, you know, I've seen some clients where, you know, there are parts where we have never gotten continuity, and I've been working with them for years. And but it doesn't mean that they're not benefiting from continuity elsewhere in their bodies. So sometimes there's really definite areas in the body that have been traumatized by, say, something like abuse or something, and we're just not able to open that door yet, and I'm just patient, and when it's ready, it's ready. It doesn't mean I don't try to integrate and get continuity in that area, but you know, it's something that I've just come to accept. And with some people, too, I also find my goal from an adjusting perspective isn't necessarily about reducing the level of muscle tension. It's really and tension in the body, I should say, connective tissue tension, really, is what a lot of it is. But it's, you know, really my goal is to just help things work better, to help remove, you know, the tension patterns that are affecting the physiology rather than decrease the tone. It's almost like really what I'm trying to do is make the body less chaotic, but maybe that's not the best choice of words because really we all are chaotic systems. But, you know, just really trying to make sure that things are working well together. And so I'm not sure that people who, you know, really want to hold a lot of tension in their body and benefit from that in terms of feeling at ease, in terms of their autonomic nervous system, wouldn't benefit from getting some care. So essentially I'm going to wrap it up with a few more things, and this is probably most important things, and it's just some foundations to work with. I've kind of got a point form list here of just a few things to keep in mind. One is establishing safety within your practice and within that relationship that you have with that person, establishing a good connection with the person and just being patient to allow that to evolve into what it needs to. You know, you don't need to step into the role of being a therapist or a best friend or something like that, but just, you know, somebody in their community, somebody that they can trust and rely on, somebody who, you know, works with them to resolve any conflicts that come up and that kind of thing, and also honors what they have to say and bring to the table and doesn't disregard it. You know, the other thing is to remember is to let go of your curiosity. I know I have some clients in my practice who have been through some horrible things, and you know what? I don't actually want to know what they've been through because I think I would just not sleep at night. And you know, you don't need to know what's going on. You just need to know how it affects them. And you know what? There may not ever be a time when they ever are at liberty to discuss it just because going there actually, you know, really brings up that level of arousal. And so really I'm there to help them with their daily life and their coping skills and help them work and that kind of thing. So remembering to just use the brakes if you see that arousal coming up, gauge and pace yourself in terms of, you know, working with these people. Sometimes, you know, you might want to avoid the anterior geometry for a little while until you get, you know, just them used to working with the posterior. It's much less intimate in many regards. And so, you know, you'll use your intuition and also dialogue with people so that they know what you're up to and what you're doing and that kind of thing. So that's a really important thing to remember. And, you know, you want to also encourage that person from a standpoint of also helping them build on their resources, both internal and external. That's really important. I think because we do sometimes get a chance to chat with people and things like that, I think that's really, really important. And you know what? I find my staff is actually sometimes really good with this. Not that I've necessarily trained them to be that way. They just seem to have an intuition for it. But they've been really, really great with working with people and talking with people and that kind of thing and supporting them through different, you know, choices that they're making in terms of, like, their health and things like that. So I've been really lucky that way. The other thing is regard their defenses as resources. You know, you don't want to get rid of coping strategies, but you want to help them have more choices so that they're not self-defeating and using them in a self-defeating manner. And the other thing to remember is that trauma means the system isn't a pressure cooker, both in mind and body. And really our goal is to reduce that pressure. So the next thing to remember, too, is to adapt your approach to the person. You know, there's going to sometimes be funny little quirks when you're working with people who've been through traumatic events and the result has ended up being PTSD. you know, so just be prepared to put aside your goals and put aside your ideal sort of adjusting process, and work with that person and adjust to them. And, you know, sometimes it's a matter of just being with the person and listening. And I find that sometimes I've had people in my practice that, you know, they're coming in for a totally different reason than what I think they might be. And so you have to just stop and listen and just honor that everyone is different. So, you know, one thing I will say is a really helpful strategy when you're working with people who have very severe PTSD issues is that describe what you're doing while you're adjusting them. Whatever lingo suits you, whether it's you're working on this tension pattern or this bone or this type of connective tissue or this organ or how deep you're going, I want it like just there's something that's just pulling 1 inch here or whatever you're seeing in the system, just verbalize it. It really sets an intent for them, and I find so many people experience so much less resistance to it if they know where your head is at. You know, they're just so much more able to engage in the process, and even though they don't understand a word you're saying, because they don't, just knowing where your intent is and what your thought process is. And I've had actually found that I have a lot easier time getting clinical results that, you know, I consider quite positive that way. I just feel like it's been really a great way to get the body on board. And for a lot of people, it really can decrease their anxiety, especially if they're anxious about having somebody's hands on them. If they've been traumatized at the hand of somebody, that can be a really big issue, and sometimes that just brings down the anxiety level to a really manageable level, and, you know, they're able to go through the process of being adjusted. So, and then I guess a couple things, too, is that, you know, really in the end, when these people go through therapy, there's a few goals there, and you know, you want to... Basically, their goals are to unite the implicit and explicit memories into a comprehensive narrative of the events and aftermath of that traumatic incident and eliminate those symptoms of autonomic nervous system hyperarousal in connection with those memories and then relegate that traumatic event to the past. And so really that's our goal, is to kind of support that process if people are in the process of going through therapy. I found some people are comfortable with that concept. Some people aren't. The very severe cases, chances are they've already been there for years, so that's great. And you're just part of that road to, you know, improving things more and more and helping them function more and more. So anyway, I think I'm done. Hello? Hello?
Hey,
Jamie, Tanya? Yeah.
I'm still here.
Okay. I don't know who's there, who's not, but anyway.
Eric.
What? I'm still here.
Does anybody have any questions? Not that I necessarily would be able to answer them, but...
I don't think I have any questions, but it was really interesting, and it just helped remind me of things that, you know, you kind of know, but you just need to go over them again.
Mm-hmm.
So that's good. I don't know what happened to Amy.
Yeah, I don't know. I felt kind of bad because my little guy was crying in the background as he was getting a bath.
He wasn't that bad.
Okay, good. So, he could probably hear my voice and was going, Mommy!
Hi, I got a question for you, Tanya.
Sure.
I missed the first couple minutes, so I'm not... You kind of focused a lot on post-traumatic stress disorder, and I'm assuming mm-hmm. that a lot of stuff is kind of lumped underneath that. What role do you think that traumatic experiences plays in with people that are experiencing autoimmune issues?
I think a very big role. From some of the reading that I've done on the subject, No, there's a lot of evidence that, you know, you will see things like chronic degenerative diseases, neurological diseases, autoimmune diseases that result from traumatic experiences. And I think part of that is just the decompensating of the body. Like when our nervous system's in that state of arousal, there's such a change in our neurochemistry, and it affects your immune system. It affects all of your systems. You will see a whole gamut of symptoms that occur because of that. So I think there is a big role as far as how much evidence there is for it yet. I'm not sure. I've seen some literature on it already, though. So I do think it does play a role.
Right. Thanks. One kind of another question on a different topic.
Mm-hmm.
What is your ideas on kind of boundaries to make sure that when people are sometimes in this state, they can be in a state that's close to unstable. And so mm-hmm. what thoughts do you have about making sure that you have your boundaries intact, and so that, you know, their stuff doesn't cross over into your boundaries? Does that make sense?
Yeah, you know, I haven't had too much of an issue with that, because I found that most people who have some issues with being, functioning stably in their lives and that kind of thing, you know, usually have a therapist, I hope, at that, you know, and I haven't had the experience where they haven't necessarily, other than when they're just not even aware of how much it's affecting their daily functioning. And really, I think actually when they're in that state of not respecting what your boundaries are, I think that's a really good time to step in and just be like, what kind of resources do you have? Because it's, you know, we're chiropractors, we're not therapists, and yet we can help kind of point people in the right direction. Because, you know, even in therapy, you know, we're not constantly available. Actually, no one is going to be constantly available. That's why people need to have a good, you know, network of resources. And they also need to work to establish that and work to not use those defenses to undermine them. You know, sometimes people will act out in anger, and really that anger is that underlying hyperarousal of their ANS. And so that's why I think it's also really important that when we come up against conflict or kind of strange behavior, that we do address it and make, not in a negative way, because we want those people to use those defenses, but when appropriate. I don't know if that helps answer the question, but, you know, I kind of, you know, have a boundary in the sense that I'm here to listen. I can advise you. You know, I'm not somebody who's in a position to advise you on your daily life, but I can listen. But the reality is I have a whole host of other responsibilities in my life. I really can't, you know, get taken off and derailed by somebody, you know, needing a lot of support. So, you know, I'm there as their chiropractor to help them through the process of working with their body, of, you know, improving their physiology and their daily life and that kind of thing. But, you know, I really can't step beyond that role. So it's just a matter of being careful yourself and helping them get the resources that they need to do that, like if they're dealing with those stuff, things. So I hope
awesome.
That answers your question.
Yeah, thank you so much. It was a great talk.
I have a question. My name is Carolyn Bickle. You mentioned something about prolonged stress. I didn't get all the notes down that I wanted to about that.
Okay.
Was there a name for it? Or?
Yeah, it's prolonged duress stress disorder. And that's where there's no events, but they're dealing with PTSD-like symptoms. So, you know, sometimes that's even just anxiety attacks and things like that. I don't know what kind of information you want on it. I have seen it clinically quite a few times. So, yeah.
No, that answered my question, just the name of it.
Okay.
I have a question for Tanya.
Mm-hmm.
How do you address, I just had something happen last week with somebody, and I'm pretty new in practice, And how do you address it when it comes up in the history? On my health history, I have a place for them to mark that they had, they experienced the loss of a loved one. And she checked that, and I asked her about it, and she just got really glazed over and blankly said to me, I think we've all been there. And that was it. And she also checked history of emotional abuse, and she said she had some anxiety keeping her up at night. So after this call, I'm putting this all together.
Mm-hmm.
I didn't know what to say to her when she said that. I just said, okay, and then I moved on to her headaches.
Well, you know, I think, you know, when I was first new in practice, to be quite honest, sometimes people would say things and I would be kind of scared of, you know, asking more questions. And, and you know, sometimes, you know, if they give you just a quick, blunt answer, you know, maybe, you know, you're a stranger. You know, you may be a doctor to them, that kind of thing. Somebody's in a position of trust for them, but you're still a stranger. And so, you know, you kind of have to read each person. Now I have a lot more courage to just, you know, ask people, you know, elaborate a little bit and that kind of thing. And remember, you don't need to know everything right away. You don't need to know what actually happened with that abuse. You just need to know when things are going haywire. And you just need to know how to help them build those resources and that kind of thing. And know when something isn't quite working with them. Like, just watch for those signs of just decompensating and hyperarousal of that ANS. So, I don't know necessarily that you necessarily have to address all that because you're not, they didn't come to you to have a therapist, you know, but you know, they'll probably find that from my experience, people in the BGI community do tend to have a lot of gifts in regards to being good counsel to people. So just,
Tanya,
I guess
a nice way to put it. And also I feel like, in the person who just asked the question, in that case, another way to open it up a little bit more and ask an open-ended question that might offer them the opportunity to give you more details is to then say, with regards to either the abuse or the loss of a loved one, is there anything that correlates in terms of the time of the event with the onset of some of the symptoms that you've marked here? And for some people, just that question will jar them into realizing how connected things are in their own experience and in their own bodies.
That's a really good point. Is that Amy?
Yeah.
Yeah.
So this is, okay, Amy, this is Stephanie Harris. I didn't say my name.
Hey, Stephanie.
Hi. Okay, both of those answers are really helpful. She just shocked me and I just moved on. I skipped the abuse after she said that and moved on to her headaches, but next time I think I could ask that question about the correlation.
Yeah, and for some people, you know, it just depends. Like in my office, I have a first visit, and oftentimes I only have one room in my office, and oftentimes there's other people in there. So it may not be actually a time that I really want to go into detail with somebody if they've marked a lot of kind of charged issues on their form, but I often will come into my office and set up a separate time for them, maybe just, you know, 15 minutes earlier, so that they know that I am willing to give them the space to have some privacy to talk about stuff like that, or to shoot an email to them afterwards and say, hey, I just wanted to check in and see how you're doing. You've been on my mind. And one of the things that I was thinking about when I was sort of going over your paperwork is I wanted to ask you if you've noticed any correlation and possibly having for her to have a disconnect between the actual hands-on stuff and the somatic experience of having somebody work on her will give her a little bit extra safety and be able to delve into the stuff on her own.
Okay. Thank you both for that.
Sure. Are there any other questions? Tanya, as always, so much great information and knowledge and wisdom. And
hopefully not
heart.
Information overload.
Well, you know, it's a lot, but it's a really intense subject. And
it is.
I feel like you do such justice because, well, first of all, everybody's so lucky because Jeff records the calls and puts them out for us so that we can take, you know, you hear one thing one time, and then if you want to listen to the download again, which is at
bgiseminars.com, isn't it?
Yep, it's the blog spot. So www.bgiconferencecall.blogspot.com. Oh dear, maybe you can cut that in, Jeff, with your own voice. But so you can go and download this call with all this rich, detailed, intense information and listen to it, whether it's over and over again or listen to a piece here and a piece there. So that's the beauty of technology, is having the information is all there for you, and you can either listen to it multiple times or listen to it piece by piece when it's a good time for you. So thank you, Tanya. I really appreciate it. And you're here from Mexico. That's such a treat. And
yeah,
I'm so glad that you're somewhere warm and beautiful. And awesome.
Yeah. Okay, cool. Well, I'll talk to you soon. And, yeah, take care.
Thanks, everybody.
This is Jeff coming in. Amy wanted me to put in the location of the calls. It's www.bgiconferencecall.blogspot.com. The location can be also linked to on the www.bgiseminars.com. You have been listening to How to Deeply and Best Serve People with a History of Trauma, presented by Dr. Tanya Tyre. This program is brought to you by the Biogeometric Integration Community Call Series, hosted by Dr. Amy Burke, recorded and engineered by Dr. Jeffrey Hoffman. This recording is copyrighted in 2010 by Dr. Susan M. Brown, all rights reserved. For more information on biogeometric integration, go to www.bgiseminars.com or call at 630-258-1054.